Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, welcome to Just the Facts with me, Alex Zane, the podcast that takes a journey through the CV of a different actor or filmmaker every week to uncover some fascinating facts about their career. At least that's the premise. As some of you will now be aware, we do go off on the odd tangent every now and then, but that's fine, right? That's natural. I'm happy with that. I love a tangent. I hope you do too. I'm guessing you do, as you are here for today's wonderful episode 18. Yeah, it's our 18th birthday. We're all grown up, 18 shows in, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you to all of you for subscribing and listening to the show. Honestly, you start a new podcast, and look, I'm aware there are a lot of pods out there to choose from these days, so I just really, really do appreciate the response so many of you have had to the show and the fact that you come back every week. I mean, it's weird sometimes. You know, we kind of make the podcast in a vacuum. I record it, do the interviews in my kitchen. I edit it in my kitchen, which is what I call my kitchen because it's very shiny. So I call it kitchen. I don't. But look, it's only when we put the podcast out there and you guys get in touch and we get an idea of how much you're enjoying the format and the tone of the interviews. So yeah, basically, thank you. It means a lot. A quick shout out as well to my producer, Grant, who I don't think I've mentioned before, but who has worked with me from the very start behind the scenes on the show. He builds our sexy graphics for Instagram and Twitter. He handles our YouTube videos. He is also the brains behind the Movie Facts and Geek Facts Instagrams, among a whole litany of other things. So thank you, Grant. On that note, while we're talking social media, if you do want to get in touch with us, we are at JTFpod on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And YouTube is where you can also watch the full interviews in glorious Technicolor the Friday after the podcast is released. And one last thing, if you do feel inclined to leave us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods, it is really helpful and it is massively appreciated. So thank you in advance and anticipation for that as well. Right, we put up a series of clues on Twitter and Instagram as to the identity of this week's guest. Huge congratulations to Frank B and Gemma Page, who were the first correct guessers in this week, working out that I have a brilliant actress, Synnøve Carlsen, on the show for episode 18. Just before I introduce her, a quick apology. About halfway through our interview, there is a little bit of background noise because right outside Tenova's window, some builders decided to dismantle their scaffolding right then. So there's a few clangs, creaks, coughs. Now, I've had a play with the audio, but I'm not the most technically skilled person in the world. Yeah, I know, try and hide your shock. But anyway, I've sorted it as best I can, but I just want you to know that I know that you know. So, I hope it doesn't affect your enjoyment of this episode, because my guest today has had an incredible career. In just 5 years, she's played the lead in the hugely successful BBC series Cleek, before jetting off to Rome to appear in the Netflix show Medici, and now has her first feature film coming out, starring in Edgar Wright's hugely anticipated horror Last Night in Soho, which I haven't seen yet. So if you haven't seen it, I'm guessing that's most of us right now, it's a spoiler-free chat. We don't go into any spoiler territories, so you can listen to this and not have the movie spoilt for you in any way. What we talk about is what it was like for her becoming part of that movie and working with the brilliant Edgar Wright. So let's get episode 18 started, shall we? Please welcome to Just the Facts, the brilliant Synnøve Carlsen. Hey, this is a fun way to start the day. This is an early interview. This is an early interview for me. Is this early for you, 9 a.m.? Yeah.
No, it is early. Not early necessarily in terms of, you know, life, but for an interview, it feels quite early.
Are you an early riser normally? Have you been up a while?
I'm not naturally, but when I'm working, I have to get up very early. A year ago, I could sleep in until like 10, and now I can't.
But then
3:45 once. That was tough.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's not acceptable, really. I mean, that's still the night before in my book. That's not even a morning.
I only go to bed at 1, so.
Wait, so you go to bed at 1 and sometimes, and you're up, well, I need an hour before I can leave.
Well, that's what I know that I'm sort of an adult now is because I need my routine in the morning. I used to get up 5 minutes before my pickup. And now I'm sort of like an hour to, you know, get ready. Down and feed my cat and have a little routine.
So. Yeah, have at least 2 coffees. Exactly. I cannot function without them. But you see, I mean, I'm a little bit older than you. I say a little bit. I'm going to stick with a little bit, actually. I'm a little bit older than you. Problem I have now is like, is when I wake up at like 5, and even if I don't have anything to do, like my brain just kicks in and I just lie awake in bed and I can't do that. I find that you have the weirdest and not necessarily positive thoughts when you're sort of lying in the dark in the small hours of the morning.
But they're not positive. They're rarely positive, are they? Mm.
No, never. It's like you just like stuff that you're absolutely fine with about 4 hours later when the daylight has kicked in. In that moment, you're just like massive anxiety, huge anxiety. What's going on?
I know. I mean, when I had this, I worked in Italy and we had 3:45, I think even 3:15 pickups because it was a period drama. Mm. So, you know, you go in and spend hours on your hair and makeup and costume and stuff. And I just couldn't, like, there were nights where I just didn't sleep. Because you're sort of lying there thinking, I've got to get up at 3:15 to go to work. So, I mean, and then that you know, those thoughts develop. You're sort of lying there and the small things that wouldn't faze you at 10 a.m. suddenly like the biggest problems in the world.
Yeah. And the advice they give you, because obviously, you know, I've looked into it. I was like, well, something I've got, there's got to be some sort of quick fix for this. But they say the best thing to get to sleep when you're awake in the middle of the night is to not think about trying to get to sleep, which is a brilliant phrase that makes absolutely no sense at like 4 in the morning.
No, what else can you do? You have to distract yourself, but then, you know, it's like, how do you, for me anyway, I have to be like listening to something. Put a podcast on, listen to something. And then if it's really good, the more interesting, the better. Because then I have to really be thinking about it in order to get to sleep.
That's interesting.
Otherwise, if you're lying there with all your thoughts, you're like, oh, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's the opposite for me. I've tried that because obviously that's another thing. But like I tried the audio book of The Hobbit, which is great.
Yeah.
But I just get into it. Like the opposite of you.
And then you're like really awake. Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, this is a great story. They should make a movie out of this. Brilliant stuff. So where are you now? Are you in London?
Yeah, I'm in London. I'm just at home.
So you've lived in London for quite a while though, haven't you?
Yeah, since I was like 12, pretty much.
But you grew up, I want to talk about this just because I love the part of the world that you grew up in. So you grew up on the west coast of Scotland.
Scotland, yeah. You wouldn't know from hearing me talk.
Did you ever have an accent?
Yeah, I did. I did. I think I just moved at that funny age where I was reading about it. Apparently, if you move before puberty, you're more likely to change your accent than after puberty hits. So I went when I was 12 and I was the only person at my school that sounded like they were from Glasgow. So you slowly start saying like glass and grass and, you know, yeah, but I have a fairly strong accent. My brothers still do. So it's a bit weird. And I sound very English.
Can you literally tap back into it at the flick of a switch?
Yeah.
The weird thing is
like when I go there, I feel like I went to a wedding recently in Scotland and we got in a taxi and my instinct is to start sort of speaking my accent. And when I was there for ages when I was doing Clique and I just spoke in Scottish accent the whole time, which is great. And it worked for the character. But then now my association with Scotland is like, you're like, foul. Like I start going into like really Glaswegian and I can't get away with it anymore because I'm not. It's weird.
It is weird, but I'm guilty. So I'm from Leeds originally. Oh, yeah. And I don't know why. I've never really had an accent. I mean, certain words, people go, hey, are you from the north? And I'm like, oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Like Toast. I don't really say Toast. But when I go back to Leeds, I dial it up. I'm just like, yeah. I feel like even though I never had it in the first place, I'm now doing a fake northern accent because I'm where I grew up. It's a strange thing.
Exactly. Just so that you feel sort of like you fit in because you know that you're from there.
Yeah.
You can't do it in front of people. That's why I've realized I'll do it on my own if I'm like in a taxi or, you know, meeting someone. But if I'm with my like friends and then I suddenly go into like, you know, Glaswegian, you can't get away with it. They're going to be like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I wonder what it is. I get in taxis. Like I'll get in a taxi in London and like you've got like a really like Cockney taxi driver with a thick London accent. And I'll start adopting. I'm like, all right, mate. And I'm like, why? What am I doing? I've never had this accent, but I feel like if I have this accent, we'll get on better.
I think we're similar then, because I think it's some sort of wanting to, I don't know. I think it's, wanting to find common ground or wanting to kind of fit in. For me anyway, like I grew up in Glasgow till I was 12. Then I moved here. I've got the most insane name in the world. Nobody knows where that's from. So I have to always, when someone asks where you're from, I have to say Norway because my name is like so Scandinavian.
Yeah.
I'm not really from Norway. I've always lived here. So then, but then, you know, you're not really from anywhere. I don't feel like I'm really from anywhere. So then you kind of dial it up amongst certain people. I was presenting at the Scottish BAFTAs a few years ago and I was telling someone a story about like, you know, growing up and they were like, you're not Scottish. I was like, no, I am. And then they were like, no, you're not. And I was like, no, I'm not, am I? I was like, who am I? What am I doing?
I thought this was going to be a fun, light award show and now I'm questioning my entire reality. Who am I? Yeah. I wonder if it helps with the acting though. Sort of like having sort of like not really sort of being sure where you're from. I just remember reading an interview with a fellow Scot actually, Robert Carlyle, years ago. And he said one of the reasons he thinks he's good at acting. I'm sure he didn't say it quite as bluntly as that, but you know, the reason he enjoys acting is because he moved schools a lot as a kid. Yeah. And so had to fit in loads of different places, which I guess is a similar thing. This idea of sort of adapting your identity based on your circumstances.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I think that's the main reason why I'm an actor, just being all over the place and parents moving about all the time. And it is that feeling of, you know, wanting to belong somewhere, wanting to fit in, and then you become quite good at. It sounds like I'm really fake now that I'm describing it.
No, I don't.
But it's sort of like shifting your, I don't know, you're quite displaced and then you're trying to like fit into different things.
people do attach a lot of weight to their identity. Like, I think people are like, you know, you meet people who are like, for example, Scotland, you know, the adage, you know, I'm a proud Scot, or like people sort of from my hometown in Leeds, they're very much like, you know, I'm Leeds, that's where I'm from. And if you never sort of really have that for whatever reason, you don't have the accent, you moved around a lot, you never spent much time in one place, you do sort of feel that you want to have that identity. So I don't think it's fake as much as it is sort of a desire to like have something that you've never actually had.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But the West Coast of Scotland, wow, what a place. I don't know what it was like for you growing up there, but to visit, I spent every summer holiday for about a decade at some point along that West Coast. So
really?
Oban, the Isle of Arran, which is beautiful. That's not far from where
that's
you grew up, is it?
Not far from where I grew up, yeah.
Where else? Skye, a bit further up north, Skye, Arisaig, Mullaig, all around there. It's such a gorgeous part of the world.
Beautiful. Yeah, no, I loved growing up there. But I am also glad that I sort of not got out, but kind of left when I did, because I think I would have probably just stayed in Scotland.
Mm.
But I, at the same time, like I loved having, doing Cleek and getting to go back there, because I kind of left. Like all of my brothers grew up there, went through secondary school. I was the last one. My parents had to move abroad. So then I moved down to England. And I sort of had this weird, like, nostalgia feeling that I missed out. And again, sort of like lost my accent and all of this stuff. But then I got to do Cleek and got to go back and live there as a kind of adult-ish. Mm. Yeah, I love it. I loved living there. And I'm glad I spent my early years in Scotland.
It's strange because we had an actor, fellow Scot, Sam Hewen, on the show, and he sounds like he had a similar story to you, where he moved away from Scotland quite young, and then he went back to, in his case, to film Outlander. And he said, like, going back there, he really sort of reconnected with what it meant to be Scottish and had this quite deep emotional connection with the country.
Yeah, and appreciation for it as well. I mean, I always loved, you sort of don't realize how lucky you are until you leave. And then you think, oh my God, that was such a special place. And then getting to go back at that time when I was maybe like 19 or whatever, go back up there as a kind of adult and get to know Glasgow in a different way, you know. Mm. I just knew it as like an 11-year-old getting the train along the Clyde, going into Glasgow, going to like Topshop, going down Buchanan Galleries, which is like a shopping centre in Glasgow. Yeah, it was quite nice to go back and kind of to see it as my brothers sort of saw it as a teenager, you know, and kind of experience it as an adult. It was really cool. Yeah, I love it.
When you moved down to London, then what was that? I mean, obviously, partly it sounds like it was because your parents moved abroad. Hmm. But was that because you knew London was the place where you could pursue a career in acting? Had you decided at that point acting?
No. No, it was just to go to school. I think it was just like an easier place for my mum to be, and my dad was living abroad, and it was just, everyone was at a different point in their lives. I'm 12 years younger than my eldest brother, so my parents had been parents for a long time, and my dad had an opportunity abroad, so it was just, you know, an easy place to be based and go to school, and but acting definitely didn't come into things until a lot.
Oh wow, that's interesting, because I think I'm right in saying you watched and discussed a lot of films when you were a kid. Like, film was quite a big part of your life when you were young.
Yeah, definitely. But I wasn't really the one on the path to do that, I don't think. I've got lots of cousins, and they all lived in Bristol, and went to like Bristol Vic and very arty. And I was a bit more, I don't know. I was just a bit, I just was a bit like, oh, that's not for me. You know, that's not what I should be doing. But then I sort of tried, like I tried to go to the National Youth Theatre and do a few sneaky things, but it just didn't really work out for me. Mm. But then I realized that I really wanted to do it, because I didn't get into National Youth Theatre, and I just started sobbing. I was like, so upset. And then I was like talking to my friends about it, and I was like, God, this is a bit weird, like my reaction. I must really want to be in National Youth Theatre. And then it sort of grew from there. I realized that, like, oh no, I really want to do this. But it was in that not getting in that I sort of realized, like, oh, I must really like this.
That's interesting. So like on a subconscious level, like a level you didn't even realize, you were like, this is something I had no idea that I wanted as much as clearly I did deep down.
Yeah. Or maybe I hadn't really allowed myself to, like, you know, think it too much. I don't know if anyone really wants their kids to be an actor. I don't know.
Did your parents have any advice?
I never said anything, but I don't think it was like, I just sort of assumed that they wouldn't want that, you know? Just because it's such a difficult path to go down and so uncertain. So I think I probably kind of hid it, but anyway, it all came out in the end. So
I wonder if it's that simple thing, because I think we all have that thing where it's like, yeah, I'm not sure about this. But the minute you're denied it, you're like, well, now I want that. Now I'm not allowed that. That's the thing I want.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was like, oh my God, that must be pretty important if I'm having this reaction.
Wait, so you have that reaction, you're sobbing. Was it in public? Were you crying in public?
I was just like with some of my friends from school, and I was like sitting in my room, and my mum was like, oh, you got the letter from that theatre thing. I didn't get in. I did get in a few years later, can I just say?
Okay. Yeah, no, of course. Yeah.
Like sitting in my room, and I was like, sorry, guys, I just got some pretty bad news. And I was like really upset. And they were like, it's okay. And then I think it dawned on me that evening, like, oh God, this must be really important to me because I'm really upset about this.
So in the few years between not getting in and getting in, what changed?
I became obsessed. I started Googling. Google was my best friend. I was just like, how to become an actress? How did Carey Mulligan become an actress? Like just literally like Googling that. And then finding like fan pages and different, you know, breakdowns of things you can do. And it was funny actually, because the thing that kept coming up was Skins. And I was like, oh, I just like need to go to one of these open castings. This was all, again, in my head, kind of like as I was trying to go to sleep, Googling all this stuff. And then in the end, the first job I actually got was the people that did Skins, their new show Clique. So it was quite funny. But yeah, I just wanted to try and figure out how I can make it happen.
So am I right in thinking that you initially got spotted at a wedding? You were singing at a wedding and you were spotted by a casting director, which on paper at least sounds like that kind of fairy tale story of how someone is just going about their regular life and then, wow.
Well, that's all the stories that I would read would be like, and I was walking through Times Square and I got spotted. I was like, God damn it, I need this to happen. But no, it wasn't that much of a fairy tale. It was a bit more vague. I was singing at a wedding. I then got talking to someone. I don't really remember because I had had a few drinks. And apparently I was sort of I do vaguely remember, but I was sort of talking to them about how I wanted to be an actor, blah, blah, blah. And they knew that I was from Glasgow originally. And then a few weeks later, I was in Norway and I got this email. I got a Facebook message from the casting director's assistant. And I was like, there's building works going on outside. And then, yeah, the Facebook message was like, do you want to audition for this series, Clique? It's a BBC Three show. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. But this could also be spam. How has this happened? I didn't, you know, put two and two together. And then I was sort of like showing people, asking for advice. And my parents were like, this seems really dodgy. Like, what are you doing? You know? I was also at drama school at this point. So I'd done a year at drama school, which was such a huge thing for me. Getting into drama school was like exactly where I wanted to be. And then I was a year in and it was like my summer and I was singing at these weddings. And then I just thought, I'll just do a self-tape. I read the script. It was really exciting. I'll do a self-tape, which I'd never done. I Googled how to do a self-tape. I did a self-tape, sent it in. And then literally the next day they were like, oh, do you want to come and meet, do some more taping? So at that point I was like, okay, this must be legit. This seems fine. It was still a bit like, what am I doing? Is this, I don't really know how this, you know, you usually have an agent or someone that you're sort of going through. And it was just me on my Facebook page.
Yeah. It seems that, I mean, to be contacted through Facebook for an audition. So it sounds on paper that you were absolutely right. And your parents were right to go, really?
Oh yeah. They were like this, you need to be really careful. You know, anyway, I went and it was fine. It all turned out to be good. And it turned out that the person I met, his brother was directing Clique. Robbie McKillop.
Mm.
So his brother, Jamie, was at this wedding. And he said to Robbie, oh, you're looking for this girl. You should meet Sinerva. I met her at a wedding. She's Scottish. She's an actress. She's at drama school. So then they reached out to me. I think they were trying to find someone who hadn't done anything before and ended up getting the part a few days later.
I mean, it's a fairly, I mean, this is your first job and it's a fairly big job. How was the audition? Did you walk out going, that went well, Sinerva, you knocked that out of the park?
I knew that they liked, I could tell they were interested.
Hmm.
It was a scare. It was nerve wracking. And then I think I ended up sort of meeting with some agents and the casting director, Jane, said, I think you need to get an agent. It's just safer that way. And then I could tell in sort of the final, we had a few meetings with different execs and people. And in one of the final ones, I could tell it was a bit different.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Because they sort of started, the executive producer, Brian, started saying kind of, if we're going to offer you this, you have to commit to it. And it has to be. And it was just a bit of a serious conversation. And then I was kind of there like, on my summer holidays at this casting. And I think in that moment, I sort of realized that it was probably going to happen and that I would have to make this really hard decision. And then I went to Hampstead Heath and just sort of like sat there for a few hours, like, what should I do?
Yeah. When you say, what should you do? As in you weren't sure whether you should take it or what you should do with yourself because you weren't sure if they were going to give it to you at that point. And you were like,
so overwhelmed with everything and kind of emotional because I had just started this drama school that I'd spent, you know, just felt like such a huge deal getting in and then to sort of throw it away. And then,
oh, I see.
I didn't know if it was, and I knew that I, you know, there was some nudity and it was just all like, I was just in every scene of this show.
Mm.
I had to sign up for two seats. It was just like a big thing. And I was there like, oh my God, a week ago I was on holiday and now I'm here and I don't know what I'm doing with my life.
Was it Parliament Hill? Were you sitting looking over London?
Yeah. By the Lido. I was sitting under a tree kind of. I keep saying that I was crying. I was crying, I think. I don't always cry, but there've been a few. I'm describing these sort of fundamental moments, you know?
Yeah.
I was sitting under the tree like, what should I do? But I decided to do it. So it was, I'm so glad I did. It was the best thing I could have done.
I think clearly it was, but what was it like for you as your first job? I mean, was it something of a learning curve? And I don't necessarily mean because of the acting per se, but just the experience of being on a set, being part of a production.
As you're describing it, I'm getting like It was so, I remember my parents came and saved me for the first week. I was in every single scene and it was, you know, 5 days a week, getting up really early, going to work. And then Friday, the first AD called, okay, that's a wrap for this week. Well done, everyone. And I was like, oh my God, we have to go. We have to go home. I went home and my dad was there and I was like, I didn't want to go home. I just wanted to stay. I just wanted to stay there. We could have done 6 day, 7 day weeks, you know? And then I just absolutely loved it. Every minute of it. I mean, after, you know, 13 weeks, you're exhausted, but I loved it so much and I learned so much and the crew was just amazing. If you wanted to be a screen actor, it was like drama. For me, it was sort of like my drama school doing Cleek.
It's weird because I guess you sort of think, were you nervous? I think that must be a question that is asked a lot. When it's your very first job, are you nervous? And I remember, so you were about 22, I think, when you got the role. I did my first TV show at 22, the very first thing I did. And people were like, oh, were you nervous? And I remember distinctly that I wasn't. It was this idea that, you know, it was exciting. And I finally got to show people what I thought, at least, I could do.
No, exactly. But then I was nervous because I was nervous about the logistical things, you know, like the, luckily Robbie set me up on a meeting with Jessica Rain and she just described like what your days will be like, who these people are on set, you know, and that was so helpful. But at the same time, I was like, oh my God, there's so much that I don't know about this. And also there's so much riding on this opportunity. So I was nervous and I went all in and it was, but it was just like exciting.
When you say a lot was riding on it, do you mean because it was your first role and it could, if it hadn't gone well, you know, that could have been it for a few years?
Yeah. And I just felt like, I don't know. I didn't know if I was good or I didn't know if it was going to be, if I was going to do it justice or, you know, like I wanted to give it everything. Mm. And it was just, it was exposing. I think that was the other thing, you know, it was exposing in various ways, not just because I had to, there was nudity in it, but also because I was in every scene and it was a real emotional journey.
And it dealt with some big themes, didn't it? It was a show that that addressed a lot in its two seasons.
And it felt to me at the time, I'm sure this wasn't true, but at the time it felt like everything was kind of riding on these few months. So I did put a lot of pressure on myself.
Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you haven't really looked back since Cleek because you went straight from Cleek onto Medici. So how were you still doing Medici when you first heard about Last Night in Soho, or had you finished by that point?
I was doing, what was that? I was on like the last week of Medici and then I had to come back for an audition for Last Night in Soho to meet Edgar and Nina Gold was casting it. And yeah, it was nice actually. I finished in December and then I think I got offered it in January. So, and we didn't start filming until whenever, May. So I had some nice time to prep. I didn't have to wait too long.
So I'm gonna come clean. So I haven't seen Last Night in Soho yet. So I am trusting you to tell me stuff that is spoiler free. Because at this point, you know, I'm a huge Edgar Wright fan. I haven't seen it. So Jocasta, by all accounts, from the little bit of reading I did do while trying to keep my brain clean from anything that might reveal too much, she is something of an antagonist to Anya Taylor-Joy's character.
To Thomasin McKenzie's character.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So Thomasin plays Eloise, comes from Cornwall and comes up to London and wants to be a fashion designer. She goes to fashion school. And my character is her main sort of antagonist in present day London. And just sort of makes her life a bit of a nightmare, which was so fun because I've never done anything like that before. You know, I was playing the sort of virginal, like, nun in Medici. And then I was there on set, like, just channeling all of the sort of mean girls at school in the year above. That's what I was doing.
So is that where you got in, how you got into character? You remembered the mean girls at school. Were there, I guess there are always mean girls at school.
Yeah, or just people that have sort of slightly turned their nose up at you in the most subtle ways, and that you've maybe, as a teenage girl anyway, like that happens a lot at school. And it's usually with girls in the year above, in my experience anyway. Just like really subtle ways of, you know, looking down on someone. Although Jocasta's not so subtle. It was really fun. It was really good.
Because there, I mean, it is something of a cliche, but you do hear a lot of actors talk about how playing a villain is just way more fun than playing a good person in a film.
It's so fun. But then again, it's really difficult because you don't know. My character's a sort of villain, but she's got some really funny moments and funny lines. I don't know. It's harder to know when you've got something right in terms of, I've never really done comedy or anything like that. But it's a different experience working with a director and trying to get a laugh or trying to get something that isn't, you know, a dramatic sort of poignant moment. It's different. Your character's there for a different reason. So it is kind of, it's a different experience. So it's challenging in those ways, but it was really fun. I did notice that the crew approached me in a different way on that job.
In what respect? Because
maybe I felt like I had to overcompensate and be super nice to try and make sure people knew that I wasn't Jocasta. I hope I'm not giving away too many spoilers. I don't think I am.
No, you're not. You're not. Everything you've said is out there. And believe me, you'd see my face drop if you gave away a spoiler. Yeah. We're definitely on the right side of the line at the moment. So wait, so you thought the crew were a bit sort of like, sheesh, this girl is...
In my head, yeah. I was like, oh my God, they're going to think I'm horrible. I need to be... And then I'm sort of walking around like, hi guys. Which I am actually, to be honest, I'm like that anyway. But I think I was just in my head. I was like, oh no, I need to make, you know, try and make up for it. But I hope they all know the real me.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. You weren't going full method then. You broke character between scenes.
Yeah.
I guess in terms of sort of like learning to do comedy and aiming for humor in a performance, you could have no better teacher than Edgar Wright. Like I said, big fan. Were you aware of his work before the film? Because yeah. I sort of worked out like. Obviously, there's an age gap. You'd have been about, I don't know, just 8 years old when Shaun of the Dead came out. Were you aware of what a big splash that made?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Hot Fuzz as well. I remember watching that, being absolutely terrified. But they were huge movies, you know. And I think I was that age where you're sort of coming into being a teenager and it's kind of on the edge of what you should be watching. But definitely. And then I saw Baby Driver. Weirdly, it was at this one period when I was like really not doing anything. And then my agency had like a few tickets to the premiere, but they were, you know, it was just like a few. And then I went on my own and it was a bit like, oh, what am I doing here? I don't really know anyone. And I remember sort of looking and it was like, oh, the cast was on the stage and he was there. I'd never really seen him in real life. And it was like listening to him. And then whatever, like a year later, I was in a room with him. So I've known a lot about him.
It was, it was quite a good interview he was doing on stage at the Baby Driver premiere. I'm not going to keep this joke going. I hosted
So you were hosting it. Yeah. Edgar was there. Lily James was there. All of the very big cast. And they all looked fantastic. And I was all excited because I got this ticket. But I obviously couldn't get a plus one, you know. So I was on my own with all these people. But at the very back, watching you, Alex. Watching Edgar Wright. And thinking, God, I've got a long way to go.
Well, it turns out it was, like you say, it was a year later. You were sitting in a room with him. What was it like actually working with him on set during this movie? Because, I mean, like, you know, as far as sort of, he's just an oracle of movie knowledge, that man, as well as a fantastic director.
Yeah, it was great. When we were doing rehearsals for a little while, he's just so funny. Like, we'd be sort of reading something and then he'd get his laptop out and then be like, have you seen this clip from this film? And he'd be like, you know, you just learn a lot. And it was really cool reading it as well. There's so much. I know his movies, they always have an amazing sort of soundtrack and there's so much that goes into the script that isn't just sort of dialogue and writing. There's like, you kind of feel like a whole essence of this movie when you're reading it. Yeah, there's just like a lot of references to sort of things he's inspired by. And that's interesting because you don't often get, I don't know, you don't often get that level of like, oh, this was influenced by this, which was influenced by this, which was influenced by this film in like the 50s and then da 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 da. And that's really cool. That's really exciting. And really, yeah, he's like a definite, he's like a holds up cinema in like a really amazing way.
It must be like sort of, I know from interviewing him, but I imagine working with him on an actual movie, it must be like film school.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think he's got this, it was actually a while ago that we shot this now, because it keeps being pushed back, the release. We shot it before the pandemic, so in 2019 in the summer. But going on to set, he has all of his sort of shots and breakdowns for the day, so you can kind of go and it's all storyboarded. Yeah, and it's really different working with him. He's sort of, you do a take and he's like, okay, we've got it. And there's no kind of bravado around like, that was amazing, or this is an amazing shot. He's just like, yeah, cool, moving on, next setup. And sometimes you work with people and they're like, oh my God, that was the best, beautiful. And you think, oh wow. And there was a moment where I was like, oh God, is this not? But it was actually really exciting and cool, because it was like a trust in your own craft. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Instead of like having to big yourself up and big up people around you, people wanted to work for him and he knew exactly what he wanted and what the result was going to look like. It's like you can trust him so much.
I guess that's a sort of like a two-way street, really, isn't it? Because, you know, you're in the film and you've gone through the audition process. He's seen what you can do. So by the point that you're actually on set, you know, he has complete trust in you that you know what you're doing. So he probably doesn't feel the need to then go, oh, let me reinforce, you know, how good you are, because it's trust.
Yeah. No, exactly, which is nice. But again, it takes getting used to, if you've been, you're insecure, if you need that, but you know, there's this lovely sense that everyone's all working together and we know what we're working towards, which was really, really nice and really exciting. There were a few times where I just remember his laugh. He's got this like very bellowy laugh. And occasionally, like mid-take, if you find something really funny, you'll just hear like ha 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 ha, like from somewhere in the studio, you know. Okay, it's good.
It's what a feature debut for you, though, for your first feature film. And, you know, you've done 5 years, I think, you've sort of been acting professionally. When you look back over your career 5 years in, what's been one of the best moments so far in terms of what you've done?
I mean, they've all been so exciting, but for different reasons. I would say Last Night in Soho, getting Last Night in Soho and going to... I think the day after I was offered it, I went to meet Anya and Thomasin, and we did a little mini table reading, and that was a working title. And I think that for me was like a really exciting sort of moment. And knowing that I've always wanted to do films. Like I've always loved cinema. So to be cast in a film by a film director that I, you know, love and have always watched was, I think, probably one of the biggest moments. Or maybe sitting under that tree in Hampstead Heath.
So did you need to visit Hampstead Heath after getting Last Night in Soho? Was that, I'm going to call them Heath moments. Was that another Heath moment?
No, it wasn't another Heath moment. But there's a lot of Soho moments in acting, actually, especially if you're kind of, you know, going to loads of meetings back in the day before COVID and before Zoom. You probably know, you go to all these meetings in Soho and then you've got all this adrenaline. You've been getting ready for your recall. And then it's over and you're sort of walking around Soho like, oh, what do I do? Should I have another coffee? You know, so Soho's been another one of those places. And I think for that Edgar Wright audition, Soho was actually, funnily enough, the place I was sort of wandering around like, what just happened?
Because obviously it's a recreation. It's of Soho in the 60s, but you weren't actually filming in Soho, were you? These must have been. Oh, you were filming in Soho as well.
In Soho, doing night shoots in Soho, closing down, like, you know, I can't remember what the name of the road was. We were filming in pubs on the street. The whole street was turned into 1960s Soho. It was amazing.
Oh, wow.
At 5 a.m. as well, on like a Saturday night. You see there's a real underground world that you assume is no longer there, but it's definitely there.
It's what's great about Soho, isn't it? It must have been really nice to be filming something that celebrated Soho. I mean, it's such an iconic part of London. And, you know, it's being redeveloped, has been redeveloped, it's changed a lot. But I think, you know, you still scratch the surface, like you said, and there is very much the original Soho buried underneath.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there a moment, like, because obviously, you know, Last Night in Soho was quite a big, it's a big film. It's your feature debut. Is there an aspect of your job that has scared you the most? Like the time that you remember genuinely being quite frightened about the prospect of something?
I'm always frightened about the prospect. I'm excited, but before I start, I'm on a job now. The Midwich Cuckoos is what I'm filming at the moment.
Oh, the John Wyndham novel.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow.
So David Farr's done an adaptation for Sky. So I'm filming that. But, you know, the night before I was like absolutely terrified and, you know, sending the director all these texts. But it's always scary, but it's kind of mixed with the good. It has to be a bit scary. Otherwise, there's kind of no cost to doing it. But I think the scariest was actually waiting for Cleek to come out that first season, because I didn't work before. It came out very quickly. Like, we wrapped in December 2016, maybe 2015. And then it was coming out in like the February or something, like really quickly. But I hadn't worked that whole time. And because it was my first job, and there was some sex and some nudity, and it was just, and drugs and, you know, all the above. And I knew that everyone would be watching it that I knew, because it was my first sort of professional job. And that, you know, that was terrifying, because I didn't know how to, I almost didn't want anyone to watch it. And I didn't know how to deal with that.
What aspect, like, what, why was it so terrifying? What aspect of it? Just like, because.
So exposing, like, it's, right. And what if I was terrible? And what if my parents had to watch it and think, oh God, she's awful.
Oh, you know? I see. It's sort of the idea of swinging for the fences with like actual sort of quite sort of extreme stuff, coupled with the idea that you didn't know if you'd been good in it.
Yeah. And also just seeing myself, like no one should ever see themselves in 3D. Ever. You know, it's not, I mean, they should, and I have to, but it's not a natural thing for like a 19-year-old. I didn't really know how to describe it, but it's not a natural thing to see you existing in 3D somewhere as not yourself. It's just a very confusing prospect.
It's interesting. So can you never sort of disassociate from the fact that it's you on screen? Like, you, well, can you watch Cleek, or are you going to be able to watch Last Night in Soho? And during the moments that you're on screen, can you sort of just enjoy it as a film, or are you always going to be watching your performance and analysing what you've done?
Yeah, so it depends on the distance that I've had from it, I think. And the best thing with Cleek, what happened was I started to watch it on that first day that it came out. I went to the screening with my dad, the first episode. And I think one of my parents, I can't remember who said this, one of my parents was like, oh, it's really brilliant, because it's, I don't see you when I'm watching it. I see Holly. And that was amazing, because then I suddenly was like, oh yeah, so do I. And then I sort of realized that I am, it's not me. But there's, you know, it's confusing at the beginning, because it's like you're critiquing yourself, but it's actually not, you're playing someone else. But I can watch things back. Like, Cleek just came on Netflix, and like people were messaging me about it. And then me and my partner sat down to watch them. And I was so proud of I was like looking, and I was so like, oh my God, this is amazing. But at the time I was sitting there like, oh my God, this is horrible. And I don't know about Last Night in Soho. I like to put off watching stuff for as long as I can, and then watch it, and then I can appreciate it, because it feels like a long time ago.
Does it change with how, I'm guessing Holly had elements that were similar to you, whereas I'm assuming that Jocasta does not. So when the character is more removed from you, as with Jocasta, is it then easier to just watch it as a performance?
Yeah, I have to get back to you, because I don't know. Oh yeah, I haven't worked that out. I would say the distance, and I just watched a short film recently for something that I did ages ago. And at the time, it was V. At the time, yeah. I was like, oh, I don't know. And I watched it back because I had a meeting with this director who was referencing it and said how much he liked it. And then I thought, oh, watch it. And I was like, oh, that was brilliant. But only because I did it 4 years ago can I now think, oh, that was great. You know, it takes a bit of time.
Was that 4 years ago? Yeah, V is really good. It's on YouTube at the moment. So if anyone wants to see it, it's a really interesting little short film, beautifully shot, and you're great in it.
Thank you.
Yeah, see, I did my due diligence before.
Good. Good work.
Thanks. Yeah, professional. Professional. So we're here in 2021. I mean, you've worked for Netflix, you've worked for the BBC, you've got your first movie coming out. When you look around sort of the landscape of the industry at the moment that you work in, what gets you excited about working as an actor in 2021?
I think I don't know what could come next. As in, it's not like the writing isn't predictable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like
when you say that, actually, just to confirm, because I mean, especially in TV, but I guess in film as well, but I think certainly in TV, people are pushing boundaries that they haven't pushed before.
And the people that are writing it and the people that are doing it, new people are being given opportunities, and it's exciting because you don't know what sort of part might come your way or what kind of, and if you can predict it, then I would say it's not worth doing.
So that's what you look for. So you want some, if you were presented with a script, it's something that you couldn't have foreseen would land in your lap that actually gets you excited about it.
Yeah. Or that I couldn't necessarily predict what this story is or what this character is. Something that's, I don't know. I'm so bad at articulating myself, but something that makes you have to really invest and look at this character and think, where is this going? And if you can predict where it's going, I don't mean like a ha-ha moment, but like if it's a predictable storyline with a predictable character, then it's not for me. I don't want it to be predictable.
That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Absolute sense. So is there a character that you would love to play? I mean, it could be either. Like, is there a historical character, a figure from history, someone who's been in the public eye that you've always been fascinated with, that if that role came along, you'd be like, that is someone who I would love to get my teeth into, metaphorically.
I've always said if they ever did an Amy Winehouse biopic, I would want to play Amy Winehouse. I don't know how realistic that is, but... And I'm sure it will happen, and I probably won't end up playing Amy Winehouse, but that's always been my dream because she's my absolute favorite singer of all time.
So you were a fan from back when she was here with us.
Yeah, huge fan.
That's a good one. And like you say, I'm sure it will happen.
There'll be quite a few people in the running for that one.
I imagine so. But, yeah. You know, for what it's worth, I would love to see you play Amy Winehouse. I think that would be great. Synerva, that has been our interview. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I've loved it. I'm sorry if I've been, you know, when you have really clear thoughts, but then you can't turn them into words.
Every single day of my life. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So I'm sorry if I've done that.
No, you haven't. You haven't at all. But I get that all the time. I'm like, I think my brain seems to think my vocabulary is better than it is. And it aims for words. And then it goes, and then you end up going, what is that word that you don't actually know?
No.
But you didn't do that. That's just me. Thank you again. And good luck with the movie. I cannot wait to see it. And thank you for a no spoilers based chat.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.